Welcome to the deep dive. You know, when most people think about insurance, their mind immediately goes to the big names, right? Allstate, Progressive, Travelers.
The ones you see on TV every day?
Exactly. They're the admitted traditional core of the market. But if you really want to elevate yourself from just being an order taker to being a true risk advisor, you have to look beyond that traditional box.
You really do.
Because the complexity, the danger, and frankly, the opportunity, it all lies in these alternative structures.
That's absolutely the core challenge. This whole deep dive is built on some advanced training materials that cover these alternative company structures. And the goal isn't just, you know, a basic summary.
Right.
We need to close the knowledge gaps that lead to, well, catastrophic professional risk. When an advisor recommends a non-traditional structure, a captive, an RRG, a Lloyd's placement, without a really deep operational understanding of the risks involved.
The ownership, the capitalization.
All of it. They're inviting professional disaster. It's a huge E&O exposure.
So I guess our mission today is pretty ambitious. We are going to map out the entire landscape. We need to understand how these alternatives, mutuals, reciprocals, captives, risk retention groups, Lloyd's, surplus lines, how they fundamentally differ from the stock companies everyone knows.
And we're going to distill the precise knowledge that gives you a competitive edge. We're focusing heavily on identifying the pitfalls, especially the lack of a safety net, and really clarifying the ethical duties required for you, the professional listening to this.
Okay, so let's start with the foundation. We have to establish the baseline, the stock company.
The standard model.
Right, they're just standard corporations. They're owned by shareholders, not the policyholders. They operate for profit, and that profit, it goes back to the investors. It's transactional, it's clear, and it's familiar to everyone.
But the minute you take one step away from that baseline, the entire relationship changes. Let's talk about mutual companies. Think about huge players like State Farm or Northwestern Mutual. Here, the policyholders are the owners. You buy a policy, you technically become a member, an owner. And this isn't some new idea, it's foundational. I mean, Benjamin Franklin basically launched American insurance with a mutual structure way back in 1752.
And that historical stability, that's often cited as their big strength. But I have a question. If a mutual company can't just issue a massive stock offering like Progressive can, how do they fund billions in expansion or maintain a massive surplus?
That's the capital nugget. They build capital the slow and steady way through retained earnings. Every single dollar of profit that isn't paid out in dividends or returned to policyholders just stays in the company.
Compounding over time.
Slowly compounding its surplus over decades, sometimes centuries. This makes them inherently stable and focused on long-term solvency, not, you know, quarterly shareholder returns.
But that has a downside.
Huge one. It fundamentally limits their ability to pursue rapid growth or make massive opportunistic acquisitions. They can't just decide to raise $1 billion overnight to enter a new market.
Now, here's where that policyholder ownership model gets a little tricky and where I think clarity is really essential for agents. If I own a policy with a major mutual, am I really an owner? I mean, in the sense that I have any say in how it's run.
But what's fascinating here is the big difference between legal ownership and practical control. Legally, yes, you are an owner.
But in reality...
that ownership is almost entirely passive. In these huge mutuals, the governance structure is often self-perpetuating. Policyholders are owners in name, but trying to get any actual influence over the board or daily operations is extreme. And they're really unique. They are an unincorporated association, which is a legal structure where the policyholders, who are called subscribers, agree to insure each other.
Right. The term Interinsurance exchange.
That's exactly where it comes from.
And the manager of this whole thing is usually this oddly named attorney, in fact, or AIF. I know clients see that on a policy and they immediately assume a lawyer is running the show.
That's the number one misconception. The attorney, in fact, is simply the corporate entity, the management company, that's authorized to run the business of the exchange for all the subscribers.
Yeah.
It is not a legal service.
And there are some big names here. USIA is a reciprocal, right? Known for incredible customer satisfaction.
It is, yes. It primarily operates as a reciprocal. Now, historically, they carried a pretty frightening risk. Unlimited liability. That meant subscribers could be assessed if the exchange failed.
So you could get a surprise bill for other people's losses.
A massive one. Now, while most modern reciprocals have engineered that risk out, the, you know, lingering potential means an advisor must scrutinize that subscriber agreement for any remaining assessment liability.
Absolutely essential.
It is. But that idea, the lack of assessment, it brings us to the concept that really defines the next couple of groups, the regulatory safety net. Before we jump into risk retention groups, we have to define two critical terms that separate the traditional market from this high-stakes alternative market.
Let's do it. Let's define them clearly. What is the difference between an admitted and a non-admitted carrier?
Okay, so an admitted carrier is licensed in the state where it operates. That means they have to comply with all state insurance laws, rates, forms, financial solvency, everything.
And they get a big protection for that?
They do. Because they are admitted, they participate in, and are protected by the state guarantee funds. Now, non-admitted carriers only authorized through the surplus lines process or by a federal exemption, and they're explicitly excluded from those state guarantee funds.
And that distinction means everything for the client's security.
Everything.
Okay, with that foundation, let's talk about risk retention groups, RRGs. These specialized liability companies were, they were born out of absolute necessity after the liability crisis of the 1980s. What is the single biggest trap for professionals placing business with an RRG?
The trap is that non-admitted status, which is actually mandated by federal law. The RRG structure was created by the Liability Risk Retention Act of 1986.
Right.
In the mid-80s, you had industries like long-term care, medical malpractice. They couldn't find liability coverage at any price. So Congress stepped in and created the RRG mechanism, allowing groups with similar liability exposures to self-insure. And crucially, that federal act preempts state regulation on certain licensing requirements.
And that preemption is the key. Mm-hmm. Because they were created federally to solve a market failure, they get to sidestep some state rules.
Including the guarantee fund contribution.
Yeah.
The critical distinctions are twofold. First, RRGs can only write liability insurance. You will not find property or workers' comp from an RRG. Second, and this is the vital disclosure professionals have to make, the 1986 Act explicitly excludes RRGs from state guarantee fund protection.
That this isn't just bureaucratic language.
No. If an RRG fails because of catastrophic claims or just bad financial management, the policyholders, your clients, are left with potentially millions in uncovered claims.
That's the difference between a hospital staying open or closing its doors forever. And I know that failing to disclose that loss of the safety net is a leading cause of E&O claims. The client just assumes they have standard protection.
It creates an absolute duty of informed consent. You're placing coverage in a market that was designed to assume high risk, and your client has to fully grasp the catastrophic consequence if that risk materializes and the RRG fails.
Okay. Let's pivot to another sophisticated mechanism, captive insurance companies. I've always seen these as insurance turned inside out. It's an insurance company that's owned by the insured to cover its own unique risks. Why would a company go through all that effort and capital outlay instead of just buying a policy off the shelf?
Well, the motivations are usually strategic. For one, they want to access the highly efficient reinsurance markets directly and bypass the traditional retail carrier's markup.
So they cut out the middleman?
Essentially, yes. They also want coverage customization, especially for emerging risks, like complex cyber threats that standard carriers haven't really standardized yet. And of course, they want cost stabilization. They want to base their premiums on their actual loss experience, not the volatility of the general market.
But hold on. If they're accessing the reinsurance market directly, aren't they just taking on the wholesale volatility they're trying to avoid in the first place? Isn't that a huge capital risk?
It is. It is a massive capital risk, which is why captives require a very high level of financial sophistication and capacity. You are effectively shifting market volatility risk, the risk of price changes, for loss volatility risk.
The risk of a massive retained claim.
Exactly. Your client has to be prepared to manage that risk, which often means retaining a substantial amount of risk within the captive itself.
And then there's the dangerous motivation you alluded to earlier, the tax benefits, specifically things related to IRC Section 831B.
That is the IRS minefield. Small captives that elect 831B can exempt a pretty substantial amount of premium income from taxation, a powerful tool. But the IRS is scrutinizing these arrangements intensely.
So what are they looking for?
If the primary driver for forming the captive is just tax savings, and the IRS decides the structure lacks substance over form, meaning it's not truly operating as a legitimate risk mechanism, they will disallow the deductions retroactively. And that can potentially bankrupt the client. The key is proving genuine insurance purpose, not just tax avoidance.
So we're talking a high threshold. This is not for the casual buy. You're talking substantial annual premium volume, right? Generally $500,000 or more.
Exactly. And it requires a sophisticated CFO who really understands risk retention and capital deployment.
Let's move from the modern captive to the historical titan, Lloyd's of London. This is maybe the most famous and most misunderstood entity in the entire insurance world because it is not, in fact, an insurance company.
That's right. And what's so fascinating is that Lloyd's is a centuries-old marketplace. It provides a venue for risk transfer. It's made up of multiple independent underwriting syndicates, all backed by their own specific capital. It is the syndicates that write the risk, not Lloyd's.
And that structural reality is really rooted in a dramatic history, especially the asbestos crisis of the late 20th century.
Oh, that crisis exposed the extreme fragility of the old model. Historically, Lloyd's policies were backed by individual wealthy members. They were known as names, who put their entire personal fortunes on the line. They accepted unlimited personal liability.
Which sounds terrifying.
It was. And when the scale of the asbestos and pollution losses became clear in the 80s and 90s, the losses just destroyed fortunes. It forced Lloyd's to dramatically restructure and shift primarily to corporate members with limited liability. That history is a pertinent reminder of the inherent risk here.
So, given that it's just a collection of syndicates, what protects policyholders today? They're relying on all these independent capital sources, not one single massive entity.
Policyholders are protected by something called the chain of security, which is a powerful multi-layered safeguard. It's a system that pools capital. So, at the first level, you have the capital supporting the specific syndicate that wrote your policy.
Okay.
At the second level, you have the members' funds. But the ultimate protection is the central fund, which is maintained by the Corporation of Lloyd's itself.
And how is that central fund financed? And when does it actually get used?
It's funded by levies, usually percentage of premium, on every single syndicate. And it's accessed only as a last resort. It only kicks in after a syndicate's own capital has been completely exhausted. This comprehensive pooled security system is why Lloyd's maintains such strong financial ratings despite its decentralized structure.
Which allows them to specialize in those massive, unusual, or complex risks that admitted carriers just won't touch.
Exactly.
That brings us finally to the market of last resort in the U.S. surplus lines, or the E&S market. This is the market that accepts the unusual, the massive, or the difficult risks that all the admitted carriers decline.
And this market is critical because many of those Lloyd's placements in the U.S. happen through the surplus lines market. By definition, a surplus lines carrier is a non-admitted carrier.
So excluded from the state guarantee fund protection.
Right. And because the client is losing that protection, the compliance requirement for you, the agent, is highly specific and very strict.
We're talking about the diligent search requirement. This is the agent's absolute shield against an E&O claim.
It is non-negotiable. Before you can place a risk in the surplus lines market, you have to perform a diligent search. You have to contact and document declinations from a minimum number of admitted insurers, it's often three, to prove that coverage was genuinely unavailable in the standard market.
And if you fail to document that search,
And the surplus lines carrier later fails, your documentation is the only thing standing between you and a massive E&O claim.
and for the client, it's not just the loss of the safety net. There's an increased cost too, isn't there?
Exactly. The placement requires the payment of a surplus lines tax, which is typically a percentage of the premium paid to the state. So it's inherently more complex, slightly more expensive, and structurally unprotected compared to the admitted market.
So if we connect all these threads, RRGs, surplus lines, even captives to an extent, the complexity just dramatically increases the agent's ethical and E&O liability. This is where your professionalism is really put to the test.
This connects directly back to our mission. The ethical agent has to manage potential conflicts of interest, especially if one of these alternative structures pays higher referral fees or commissions. And suitability matching is paramount. Recommending a structure the client can't understand or financially sustain is just setting them up for failure.
So you have to match the complexity of the solution to the client's sophistication.
And their financial capacity, absolutely.
So the shield is the documentation, but the core duty is really disclosure.
Full, comprehensive disclosure. All your due diligence needs to be documented, and all critical disclosures, especially that guarantee fund exclusion for RRGs and surplus lines, must be documented, signed, and acknowledged by the client. That record is the only way to prove that the client made an informed, conscious decision to accept higher risk in exchange for flexibility or cost or just availability.
We've really covered the entire spectrum today, From mutuals with their focus on stable, long-term solvency, to the high-risk federal structure of RRGs and, you know, the unique historical marketplace of Lloyd's. Understanding this whole landscape is what turns you from a typical agent into a truly indispensable risk advisor.
And this leads to the ultimate test of integrity in this complex market.
Mm.
If the traditional, protected, admitted market is available, but a client insists on a non-admitted alternative, a surplus lines carrier or an RRG, solely because it offers a marginal cost reduction, that savings comes with the absolute loss of the state safety net.
That's a huge trade-off for a small savings.
A huge one. And it raises a critical question for you. When does the ethical obligation to disclose the lack of guarantee fund protection become an obligation to actively counsel against the placement for an unsophisticated client? That is the question every professional in this space must answer when they're placing business in this shadow market.